Oh, man. All right, I'm done. Hi, everybody. My name is Alec. I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Sunday Night Asbill Caesar Group. My sobriety date is June 12, 1990, and I'm going to do what my sponsor told me to do tonight. And instead of telling you that I'm terrified, I'm going to tell you that I'm really excited to be here. If only that were true. I would definitely like to thank Melissa and the members of her committee for asking me to speak tonight. You know, I learned a long time ago that it is truly an honor to give back to this program that has given so freely to me. And I can tell you I would not have the life I have today if it was not for this program. And for that, I am eternally grateful. Tonight, I'm going to try to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it is like today. Yes, I am going to talk to you a little bit about a drunkalogue tonight because it's very important, and I know it was for me when I was new in the program. You know, because when I sat in my very first meeting and I heard people talking about the steps and about recovery and all that kind of stuff, I had absolutely no idea what you were talking about. I had no idea. But when you were talking to me about how you were skunk drunk driving east on a westbound lane, that was something I could understand. You know, and we'll talk about that more lately because, yes, that is a part of my experience in my life. You know, I knew I was gay at a very early age in my life. I knew it in junior high school. I knew it in high school. It made me a target, you know, and it was pretty ruthless in school. I hated it, you know, but I did the best I could. You know, but I spent every single day of my life lying about who I was, what I was, because I tried so hard to fit in. You know, my life was filled with fear, with angst, with frustration, with sometimes anger. You know, and I really didn't know what to do with it, and I didn't exactly have what kids have today, you know, with gay proms and teachers who know about that kind of stuff. I mean, I didn't have parents who wanted to talk about that. I certainly didn't have teachers who wanted to talk about that, you know, because nobody knew what to do with it. So I was kind of out there on my own, you know, trying to deal with something that wasn't popular to deal with. You know, I'm going to talk about something tonight that for many, many years, I never talked about, you know, and I'm going to apologize in advance if I offend anybody, but it is not my intention to. But I was molested as a child, you know, but it's very important that you understand I don't put it in the context that most people do. You know, I was a gay kid who had a teacher, you know, that yes, he took advantage of me. But I don't see it in the typical way that most people do when they're molested. To me, that was my refuge. It was the one place in my life that I actually got to be just me. You know, I didn't have to lie to anybody. I didn't have to behave in a specific way. I could just be myself without fear of any kind of retribution. You know, and it's a battle between me, and my therapist, because my therapist really wants me to be angrier about it, you know, and I just can't be today, you know, because I know how important that was. And make no mistake, I know what he took from me. You know, I understand that, but I also understand what he gave me. He gave me the one place in my life, in my childhood, that I could feel safe, that I could feel a part of, that I could belong to something. And at that particular time in my life, when I literally had none of that, it was the most important thing I had. You know, so it was something that I looked forward to. I was not this naive kid who did not know what was going on. I knew exactly what was going on, and I took active participation in it. You know, the rest of my school year was very frustrating, you know. I mean, constantly being beat up, bullied, picked on, you know, money getting stolen from me. It was just a miserable existence. And if that wasn't enough, when I was a senior, at the end of the year, you know, they have this award ceremony thing, you know, where they honor the best in science and math and gym and all the rest of that stuff. And my class decided, they thought it was kind of funny, that they would vote me most likely not to succeed upon graduating high school. And they did that in front of the entire senior class and all of the parents. You know, and for a long time I used to tell you that it doesn't bother me. But I will tell you today that it really does. You know, I have worked on this particular issue, and I have come to realize how much that hurt, you know, and how betrayed I felt. You know, which is why when I found alcohol, I never drank socially. I drank for effect from the minute I picked up the bottle. You know, I hear people talk all the time about how they started out socially, you know, a drink here, a drink there, and then it progressed. Not my experience. I can't identify to that at all. The minute I had a drink, I thought I was home. You know, this was the one thing that was going to take me away from all of this insanity and all of this crap that was going on in my life, and I could create my own little world, drunk as a skunk. And that's how I lived the rest of my life. I drank with abandon. Yes, I used other recreational activities, and make no mistake, I was an equal opportunity user. You know, if it was there, I did it. Didn't ask what it was, didn't care what it did. As long as it took me out of myself, it was perfect for me. And so, and that's how I lived my life. And I was quite content with being dead by the time I was 30. I thought living 30 years of life, that was going to be more than enough. You know, and so that's how I drank and I drugged. You know, I used to tell people that I never lost a job due to booze. Well, today I can honestly sit here and tell you that I lost not one, but several jobs because of booze. You know, and by the time things came crashing down all the way up in New York, the best job I could get was the midnight to 7 a.m. shift at the 7-Eleven. You know, that was the best I could get. You know, and most of the time, whoever came in at 6 a.m. found me drunk in the cooler, passed out. You know, and that was perfectly fine with me. I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. You know, and I'm going to tell you a story because it's the one day that I actually was sober. You know, and yes, it was the one day I was sober. For those of you who know Long Island well, there was a whole group of us packed in a little Ford Mustang, and we were going down to Ashwaukee Beach, and I was driving. And there were five people packed in the back and two people packed in the front seat, in the passenger seat. You know, and I don't know what it was. We were kids. We were reckless. We didn't really care about anything, you know. So we weren't really safety precautious, so to say. You know, there was no such thing as a seatbelt or anything like that. We were usually drinking and snorting lines as we were driving down the road. Anyway, like I said, this was the one time that we were sober. And for some reason, the couple in the front seat decided to put their seatbelt on. You know, and we were coming down to Ashwaukee Beach, and if you know it well, it comes up from a high cliff, and it comes down, and then it goes into a really steep curve. And I decided to take that curve going 50 miles an hour, sideswiped a car, and drove head-on into a tree. You know, and I have thought about that day a lot, you know, wondering what was I thinking, what was I trying to do. You know, and I honestly can't tell you, but I pray about it every single day. But what I can tell you for sure is there was something going on in my life on that particular day that I didn't recognize and I didn't see, because there was no reason for those people to put the seatbelt on that day, but they did. And I can tell you, if they hadn't, I certainly wouldn't be standing here sharing my experience, strength, and hope with any of you, because I probably would have killed them. And that would have been something that I have to carry with me the rest of my life. You know, when I recognize today, that's a yet in my life. And for those of you who haven't been around long enough, stick around long enough and you'll learn what those yets are, because I have a lot of them. You know, I had a pretty short drinking career, but it was colorful. I can tell you that this is back when, you know, grocery stores used to be honest and you could write them checks and they didn't swipe them through that machine and it would clear your account instantaneously. They kind of went on the honor system. Big mistake with me, you know, because I decided to write about 35 checks in 1 month and I had no money in the account and they all bounced. Cost my mother a pretty penny in settling that with the attorneys and with Pathmark and with Riverhead Savings to the tune of about $30,000, $40,000, if I remember correctly, because they wanted to come after me for check fraud and bank fraud. I stole the deed to my mother and father's house, and I pawned it once. I was a real charmer. Believe me, if my mother and father knew then what they know now, they probably would have traded me in for a different model. But it is what it is. You know, and I guess we do what we have to do to get here. Needless to say, as I was talking about earlier on, this last job that I could possibly have on Long Island, you know, clearly my life was going in the right direction, you know, the midnight to seven shift at 7-Eleven, and that's really the best I can do. So I decided, I had a friend of mine, an old boyfriend of mine, who decided to move down here a couple of years earlier. And so he called me out of the blue. And, you know, and he just said, you know, I've got this room down here if you're interested in coming down. You know, well, it's not like I had a whole lot to look forward to up there on Long Island. So I packed up a suitcase and I hopped on a plane and on down to Florida I came. You know, and I came down here thinking that, you know, well, it's a different state, it's a different environment, things are going to be much better, you know, even though the relationship was batshit crazy up there in Long Island, of course, because down here in Florida, it's going to be different. You know, that's the insanity of my mind, you know, which is why today I kind of stay out of it. I kind of put a lock on that door up there, and I stay out of it, because it's a dangerous place to be, you know. So on here I came, and this is my one and only real geographic. You know, needless to say, about 6 months into that stay down here, things weren't really working out with Stephen. And so he had a friend of his named Angela who lived, and this was an apartment up in Coconut Creek, Deerfield. You know, and he had a friend of his, Angela, that lived down near downtown Fort Lauderdale, Sunrise and Northeast 15th, over in that particular area. And so she decided to rent me a room, and I went down there on a weekend, you know, and I popped into Moss Brothers Jordan Marsh, which I believe at the Galleria Mall, that's the Dillard's now. For those of you who have been down here a long time, you'll remember Moss Brothers Jordan Marsh. And excuse me. And I got myself a job there, you know, down in downtown Fort Lauderdale I went, you know, and I managed to hold on to that job for a couple of years, believe it or not. But thank God for Bill and Betty, you know, and the checkbook up there on Long Island, because when things were getting tight, and they always were, I could make a phone call and threaten to come home, and the check would be in the mail very quickly. yeah. So anyway, I was going along on Moss Brothers Jordan Marsh, and I was working in the Liz Claiborne in the IZOD department, and there was this guy named Bob K, who worked in the Polo department right next door. And he and I were fortunate enough to have the closing shift there, so we got there at, you know, like around 2 o'clock, and we were there till, you know, 9 or 10, whatever time it was. You know, and we would always go to lunch at 4 o'clock, you know, and he would always want to go eat, and I would always want to go to the club and, you know, have a couple of drinks, you know, because that was really the only way that you were going to get through the rest of the night. You know, and I'll tell you, we would go, and he would sit there, and he would always order a Coke. You know, and you know how sometimes you just get that sick feeling, like, you know, I'm really not going to ask him why he does that because I probably don't want the answer. You know, I was smart enough to know that. You know, so I never really asked him about that Coke, even though I knew. You know, because I had exposure to this program. My mother and father had gotten sober a few years earlier. You know, my mother died sober, God rest her soul. You know, and they had a lot of their friends in this program that were kind of around my age that they thought, you know, maybe, you know, if I go to meetings with them, that somehow this will catch on. But, you know, we're ready when we're ready, and we get it when we get it. And hopefully, God willing, we find our way here. You know, and yes, I managed to do that today. So I never really asked him. But I went about my business with my drinks. He went about his business with his Coca-Cola. You know, we never really talked about it. You know, and then there was June 12th, 1990. And it was a day like any other day. You know, I got up that morning, I took my shower, you know, and I shaved and I did all that stuff and got ready for work. And I was looking in the mirror that morning and I just broke down and started to cry because I knew at that point my life was over. You know, I couldn't do this anymore. You know, when I was either going to get sober or I was going to kill myself. You know, and it's only because, and I believe this in my heart of hearts today, it's only because I did not have the courage to take my own life that I'm standing here in this room. But I didn't realize it then, but I certainly see it now, that God was putting all of the right pieces on the chessboard in all the right places. You know, because Angela, she worked in a detox, so she was familiar with this program. You know, she got me a cup of coffee. We sat down on the couch. I cried a little bit. Bob took care of me not going to work that night. he called out sick that night, and that night, Bob took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. No surprise there. You know, and it was at the Lambda Club, and it was on a Tuesday night. You know, and a Tuesday night meeting was always packed. And, you know, when I walked in this room and I saw all you people laughing and joking with each other and talking with each other, and I swear to God, I thought you were all drunk. Because I could not imagine in my life how you could feel that good. You know, because I hadn't felt that like that in years and years and years. I hadn't been able to laugh at anything in years. You know, and so I didn't get it and I didn't understand it. You know, I have no idea what was talked about that night. I couldn't begin to tell you. I remember I sat in the very back of the room next to the door because I wanted to get the hell out of there as fast as I could. You know, and I just remember at the end of the meeting, there was this chip thing, and I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. You know, but they did say, if you want to start a new way of life, here's a white chip. Come and pick it up. And I can tell you that my legs were shaking so bad that there was no way in hell I was going to get from the back of the room to the front of the room to pick up that white chip. And that particular night, that guy just said, I'm going to leave it here on the table in case you're shy. You know, and I am so grateful to this day that he did that for me. You know, because otherwise I would have not picked up my white chip. If I had to walk up in front of you all, I would have never done that. You know, but after the meeting and after everybody snuck out of that room, I snuck up there and I slid that white chip off the table and I put it in my pocket. You know, I thought it was being really slick, you know, that, you know, nobody was going to see this. And of course, everybody saw it and they came up and they were giving me hugs and, you know, and they were, welcome, it's so good to have you here. And I just kept thinking, what do you want from me? Because, you know, nobody is nice to anybody in my world and in my life unless you want something. You know, you certainly weren't doing it because it was the right thing to do. I didn't get that concept at all. You know, that was not a thought that ever crossed my mind ever. And they just said, come back tomorrow night. There's a meeting here tomorrow night. Come back. You know, and that's exactly what I did. And I was coming back every single day. And then I remember I was at this meeting and they were talking about this thing called sponsorship. You know, and I had no idea what they were talking about, but I certainly couldn't let you know that, even though you did, you know, even though you knew that. But I had no idea what they were talking about, you know. But I did get enough out of the meeting to know that, okay, well, this is somebody who's going to help you. So I figured, well, okay, you know, this is the way my mind thinks. You know, it's real brilliant up here. I went to the cutest guy in the room, and I asked him to be my sponsor. You know, because I was thinking, well, if I can get a little piece on the side, you know, this is all good. You know, I mean, this is how I think. You know, it's. Do you understand now why there's a padlock on the door? You know, but I figured, okay, you know, and so he says sure, but he doesn't say anything else to me. So I figured, well, okay, this is going to be great. He's going to be my sponsor, but I don't have to talk to him about anything. This is perfect. You know, I mean, what more could a guy ask for? You know, but I was still coming to meetings. And I can't tell you why I was still coming to meetings, but I was. I guess at that particular moment, I had a desire to be sober more than I had a desire to drink. I just didn't know that. You know, but I was grateful for it. You know, so I kept coming to meetings. And then I was hearing these people talking about the steps and all of that kind of stuff. You know, when they're working with their sponsor and the steps and all of that. And I didn't know what that was. I just knew that it was 12 sentences up there. And I could tell you 9 of the 12 I wasn't interested in. You know, there were a couple that I figured, well, you know, perhaps. But the other ones, the God ones and stuff, oh, no. It's not going to work for me. You know, but I did go up to Jeff and I asked Jeff. I said, you know, well, I want to talk to you about, like, this step stuff, you know, because I've got, you know, a couple of these guys that came in with me, and they're working with their sponsors on this step stuff. And he says to me, he says, well, you know, if you want to meet me, I'm at the Bar 825, ironically the same club I used to go to at dinner time when I was working at Moss Brothers, Jordan Marsh. Now, believe me when I tell you, I am not the brightest bulb in the box, not by a long shot, but even I knew that does not add up. I mean, I'm an alcoholic, I'm brand new to recovery, and you want to talk about the steps of this program in a bar? You know, there's just something that's not ringing here to me. You know, so I didn't go to the bar that night. I stayed home. But the next day, I was standing, like, just on the other side of the door jamb in the back room at the Lambda Club, and I was talking with a friend of mine, and I was telling him this story, you know, and I'm like, I don't know, it doesn't make sense to me, and I'm like, I don't think that this is going to work out. And this guy, Wayne, comes from on the other side of the wall, and he's hearing this entire conversation, and he comes around through the door, and he grabs him by the arm, and he says, I'm Wayne, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm your new sponsor. And today you're not going to sit in the back of the room, you're going to sit all the way up in the front. I said, okay. So we sat all the way up in the front. And as we were sitting there waiting for the meeting to start, we were kind of having a little meeting before the meeting, and he was talking to me about some of the things that I had to do. And he said to me, listen, he said, you're going to hear this thing about 90 meetings in 90 days. That doesn't work for you. I said, well, what do you mean? He said, you need to go to a meeting every single day. It's like, for how long? You know, what the hell? You know, when he says, let me ask you something, Alec. Did you drink every day? And I said, well, yeah. He said, did you spend a lot of time at that bar every day? I said, well, yeah. You know, of course, I was drinking, I was having fun. He said, if you can't find 1 hour every single day for your recovery, maybe you're not ready to be here. He said, you know, Alec, this is about life and death. And if it's not about life and death for you, maybe you're not ready to be here. You have to think about that. Think about that real hard, you know, and he really caught me off guard, you know, because I was on a tear here early in sobriety. This was going to be a breeze, you know, and now this guy is telling me that I, you know, I got to go to a meeting every single day and that this is about life and death and all right, you know, and he says, and oh, by the way, you have to call me every day. And I said, well, what happens if I have nothing to talk to you about? He said, then say hello and we'll start a conversation. I said, okay, and he said, and by the way, I get home from work at 5:30, and I'm there until 7:30. You need to call me in that two-hour time slot. And I said, well, what happens if I need to, you know, what happens if, why can't I just call you and leave you a message during the day? He said, no, that's not how this is going to work. I need to have a conversation with you. You know, and I can assure you that if there were the cell phones and the texting thing, he would tell me, don't even bother. Call me between 5:30 and 7:30 every single day. So that's what I did. And this went on and on and on for a few months. And then I started talking to him about this steps thing, you know, because I was watching all of my friends going through the steps. And he says to me, he says, don't worry about your friends. Right now you're on step one, and that's where you need to stay for a little while, because that's the only one you need to do perfectly. That's the one you have to get perfectly. The other 11, you don't have to do them perfectly every single day. You just have to do the best you can. But step one is one you have to do perfectly, and you have to know, not up here in your head, but here in your heart, who you are. And then you have to find a way to accept that. And once you've done that, then you've opened the door to the other 11 steps of this program. And I stayed on that step for a full year. He kept me on step one for a full year. You know, and we talked about a lot of things, and, you know, and we shared a lot of experiences. And you know what I had found as I look back on it over that year? I pretty much worked all 12 of the steps in that year. I just didn't know it yet. And so when it came time to work those steps as we progressed in our program, I was able to draw back on all of those experiences and say, oh, now I've got something to identify that step with. And that saved my life. You know, it really did. I remember I was sober, oh, I don't know, 9 or 10, 11 months, something like that. I can't really recall. But it was somewhere, I know I was under a year. You know, and there was this TV show that was going to come on. It was this miniseries, and I had been watching the previews of it, and I was really excited about it. I thought, you know, this is great. I really want to watch this. And so the particular night where the first episode is going to air, you know, I call Wayne that day between 5:30 and 7, you know, 7:30. You know, and I say, hey, listen, Wayne, I said, I'm going to take tonight off because there's this TV program on that I really want to watch, you know? And he says, whatever you think is more important, Alec, click went the phone. So I thought, great, I got my pass. So I just got approval, you know, and so It's about 5 minutes to eight. You know, I'm getting myself, trying to get myself comfortable on the couch, you know. But you know how, you know, there's just something there that you can't find a comfortable position. There's just something there gnawing at you. Because all I keep thinking in the back of my mind is whatever you think is more important, Alec, son of a bitch. You know? And that particular day was the very first time, other than the day, and not even the day I came to this program, it was really the first day that I was sober, that I made a conscious decision to put my program ahead of my rest of my life. My program came first that night. You know, and I thank God for Wayne. He had a way of making his point with a little bit of humor and a little bit of condescension and a little bit of sarcasm. A guy like me needed that, you know, but he made his point. Because all I kept thinking about as I was sitting there trying to get comfortable is whatever you think is more important, Alec. You know, and I've never looked back from putting my program first. You know, and I am so grateful to Wayne for that. Man, all right, let me, I have had an amazing life in this program. I really, really have. I've had an absolutely amazing life. I faced the death of my mother in this program. I faced the death of my partner of 18 years in this program. You know, and we'll talk about that. You know, I've traveled the world. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams, and every single day that I stay sober, there's the possibility of it getting better, and it actually does. You know, when my mother died, I had an opportunity to mourn her death as she was dying. You know, she was home with hospice, and I helped my dad take care of her. She and my father had moved down here. They had been down here probably 4 or 5 years, 6 years before my mother was re-diagnosed with cancer. And I really had the opportunity to mourn her death. And don't get me wrong, when she died, I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated. But I also had a sense of peace, you know, when she died. Because I knew that she wasn't in pain anymore, she wasn't suffering, and she was going to be okay. When my partner Bernie was diagnosed with cancer, about 4 years, 5 years later, I think it was, I thought I would be able to do the same thing with him. But that loss, it's very different. Sorry. Yeah, right? Yeah, I should try to breathe. That would probably help. There's an intimacy in that relationship that you don't have with anybody else. There was not anything about me or about my life that Bernie didn't know about, you know, and there wasn't anything in his life that I didn't know about, you know, and when he died, I was so angry. I was so angry. I was angry at God. I was angry at this program. I was angry at all of you, and I had hatred in my heart, you know, because everything that I had worked for got ripped out from underneath me in an instant. And I had the darkest period of my recovery. You know, I thank God that I never picked up a drink during that period, but believe me when I tell you, I came close quite a few times. There were quite a few times that I picked up those keys and I walked out the door, but instead of getting in my car, I walked back in the house and I put the keys down. You know, because that was the solution that had worked for me in the past. You know, and I believe that it could work for me again. That's the insanity. You know, thinking that I can do the same thing over and over again and I can get a different result this time. But I know in my heart that's not true. You know, so I did another quasi-geographic. I had to get the hell out of Florida, so I moved out to Las Vegas. I'd have been better off at a bar. You know, I stayed out there for about 6 months. And then I made my way back here. You know, I knew as soon as I got off the plane in Las Vegas, I knew as soon as I put everything and I took everything and unpacked it all, put all the art up on the walls and loaded the refrigerator with food and put the TV on and hooked all of the telephone up and the cable up and all that crap, I knew that there was no way in hell I was going to stay here and I might as well just start packing now. You know, and 6 months later, I was back in Florida, but still angry. Still angry. Still frustrated. You know, and want nothing to do with any of you. You know, and I had a moment, I had a crisis of faith. You know, and I had what I call a God moment. You know, I was just sitting in the back of a building next to the trash can in my car thinking, okay, am I going to go drink or am I going to go to a meeting? Am I going to go drink? Am I going to go to a meeting? And I decided to come home that night, and at this point I was living with my dad and my stepmother. You know, when I told him, I said, I need to recommit to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went to a meeting that night. And it was the Tuesday night, it was the Wednesday night Asbill Caesar group in Coral Springs. You know, and I sat down in that meeting, and as soon as the meeting started, I knew I was home. You know, I knew that I was in the right place. And I went to meetings every single day, you know, and I remembered what I did when I first got into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I got myself a sponsor, but it wasn't a great connection. And I knew that in my heart, it wasn't the right connection. So I had to go searching for another one. You know, when I found a guy named Brian, you know, when I was talking with him about all of the stuff that I had been through in my life, all of the stuff that I went through with Bernie, and how I was feeling today, you know, and he said to me, he said, well, you know, he said, do you know what general service is? And I said, well, I kind of know what it is, but I'm not really interested in general service, you know, because, you know, there's too much ego there, there's too much politics there, and I really don't do well with that kind of stuff. I don't have the patience for it. You know, I really don't. And Brian just said, you know, I'm going to share my experience with you. I was a part of District 9. I was the secretary treasurer. At one point, he was the archives chair, and he talked to me about how he built his committee on the archives and how he really enjoyed it and how he was the GSR workshop coordinator, and he really enjoyed that because it gave him the opportunity to carry the message. And, you know, and he didn't get involved in the politics. He said, I got to decide what I got involved in and what I didn't get involved in. You know, I got to make that decision, and you'll get to make it too. And I said, well, you know, Brian, I'm not really too sure how to go about doing this. And he said, well, you know, your home group, the Sunday night Asbill Caesar group in Coral Springs, and that's the better one, just as an FYI, your general service representative, your GSR, is going to have to sit down for health reasons. And maybe you can ask your group at your next business meeting when they ask if that position is available. And if it is, you can stand for it. You can give your qualifications and see if your group will elect you. And so I said, okay, so I'm going to do this. And I stood and my group said, absolutely, we'd be grateful to have you as a general service representative. I was like, well, what now? And Brian said, well, you're going to go to the next district business meeting, you know. And there was another woman that I had gotten really close with in my time going to meetings out here in the Coral Springs area. Her name was Jamie M. And a lot of you in this room know who she is. You know, and Jamie was a big part of District 9 and still was active in the district at that particular time. You know, and so, you know, I said to Jamie, I said, I'm not really sure how this is supposed to work. And she said, when you get there, you're going to sign up in this book, and then they're going to ask you to come down as a new GSR, and you're going to give your name, your sobriety date, and a GSR. And, you know, at 12 o'clock, there's the GSR workshop, and that's where you learn about what a GSR responsibility is. And a year and a half after rotating out of being a GSR, I finally know what they do, which is pretty typical with service commitments here in Alcoholics Anonymous. We figure it out once we're done with it. And then I sat next to Jamie, you know, because Jamie was the only person I knew, and she was somebody that I trusted. I trusted her opinion, I trusted her instincts, and I really didn't know a lot of other people in District 9, because, you know, I mean, I didn't know who you guys were and what was going on here, you know. And so Jamie would take the time as the meeting was going on, and she would sit next to me, and she'd be like, Alec, okay, you know, this is what's going on here, and this is what they're doing there, and she was teaching me. You know, and I was really grateful for that because she made it interesting. You know, otherwise it would have been just a bunch of whatever, people talking about I don't know what. And that's what it would have been to me. So she really made it very interesting. You know, when I was rotating out of my GSR position to become an alternate district committee member, which is what I am now, as a GSR, you know, when we go to these quarterlies and stuff like that, you know, you get your groups to fund you. You know, well, when you're an ADCM, you know, the district doesn't fund you and the groups don't fund you. But if you're a committee chair of, like, one of the many committees that are a part of District 9, you do get funded. You know, so I started thinking about becoming a chair, and I didn't, and I'll be honest, I did not have the best motives when I was going there. You know, and because it was really about getting funded, because I didn't have the money to go to these things on my own. And I wanted to go to them because I really enjoyed being around people and I really enjoyed learning, you know, but I didn't have the money to do it, you know. And so, and I remember talking to Brian about it, you know, and Brian said to me, he said, Alec, it doesn't matter what gets you there. What matters is what you do with it once you have it, you know. And so I was talking with a good friend of mine, Sherry, who was the special needs chair of District 9 at the time, and she was rotating out, and she was telling me about the special needs committee and what's involved in it, you know, when she thought that that might be a good fit, and I thought that that might be a good fit. You know, and again, in the beginning, it was all about getting funded so I could continue to go to these quarterlies, you know, without shelling out those few hundred dollars out of my own pocket, which I didn't have, you know. But I kept remembering what Brian said. You know, so at the Sherry's very last meeting, she had me come down, she introduced me to her committee, you know, and she was talking about some of the projects that they were working on but hadn't quite completed at that particular time. You know, and I thought, well, okay, here we go. And one of the projects she was working on was a big deal in our district, but it was also a big deal at the area level too, and that was getting people who are in assisted living facilities access to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I set out to do that, and I knew that I couldn't do that on my own, and that our committee couldn't do that on our own. So I tapped the shoulder of another chairperson of the PICPC committee, which is the Public Information in Cooperation with the Professional Community Committee, and her name was Sharon, and I know she's here tonight. And I tapped her on the shoulder, and I asked her, I said, listen, I said, I know that you go to speak to all of these professionals, these doctors, these nursing homes, and all of that kind of stuff, and do you think it would be okay if I tagged along? Because while you talk about and introduce what Alcoholics Anonymous is, I can talk to them about if they can identify any patients who do self-identify that can't get to meetings. That's where I can come in, and I can help them. You know, and we've been bringing meetings inside of ALFs. We've been bringing people who have difficulty getting out on their own to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's wonderful, and it's absolutely amazing. And I'm getting ready to rotate out of that position at the end of this year, and I'm praying to God that my co-chair, Melissa, wink, wink, you know, that come October when we have elections, she's going to stand for that position. Because this year, I'm going to do what Jamie did for me and what so many others in District 9 did for me. And I'm going to teach her what it means to be the chair of this committee. And I'm going to start passing off those responsibilities and sharing with her my experience on how it worked for me so she can continue the efforts that we started last year, we're continuing this year, and then she's going to move on, hopefully in future years, and we're just going to watch this thing blossom. You know, I went from wanting it for one reason to get funded, and I ended up loving what I was doing. You know, because what we became was a group of alcoholics in action carrying the message of recovery to alcoholics who otherwise couldn't get access to it. And that is the most important thing we do every single day. You know, do I miss Bernie every day? Yes, I do. Do I miss my mom every day? Yeah, I do. Do I miss all of the people I lost in this program because they made a decision to go out and use and didn't make it back to this program? Yeah, I miss them every day. You know, but the best way I can honor them is to stay sober and to continue to carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers. So if there's a single message you get here from me tonight, please let it be that. It is the most important thing we do every single day. Thank you so much for this incredible honor to speak.